Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
All right, here you go, straight from the horse's mouth.
Effective immediately, I am banning Mr. Sterling for life from any association with the Clippers organization or the NBA.
Life plus $2.5 million, so says the commissioner of the National Basketball Association. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Tuesday, today the 29th of April. Great, as always, to have you with us, gang. NBA Commissioner Adam Silver threw the veritable book at Donald Sterling today. Sterling is, of course, the owner of the Los Angeles Clippers, who was recorded making what can charitably be described as racist remarks the other day. Silver has banned Mr. Sterling from the NBA for life, as you heard him say, and hit him with a $2.5 million fine as well. Kevin Arnovitz covers the NBA for ESPN.com. Kevin, it's good to have you on.
Thanks for having me.
Give me the gut check. What do you think of this thing?
It was a strong statement by the commissioner. Adam Silver levied the maximum fine he was able to levy under the NBA Constitution, $2.5 million on Sterling. And more than that, he banned Sterling for life. That means Sterling basically has to disappear.
He can't go to games, he can't buy tickets, he can't show up at a rally, any of that stuff, right?
He cannot deal with sponsorship. I mean, he is basically shut off from the Los Angeles Clippers' day-to-day operations.
All right. I will point out here that this guy is a billionaire, so $2.5 million is less than chump change.
Right, and symbolically, it is the maximum fine, and I think that is the important statement. Obviously, it's not going to affect his livelihood.
The commissioner said today he wants to convince the other 29 owners in the NBA to force Silver to sell the team. He needs three-quarters of the remaining 29, I guess. Is that going to happen?
It can happen, and I don't think Silver makes that statement. And he closed his press conference today by saying, I have the full support of the owners to act.
Yeah.
He doesn't make that statement without consultation with ownership groups. He doesn't make that decision without the consultation of the players' union.
Is it too soon to talk about how much he might get for this team?
No, it's a fun parlor game.
And, all right, so let's go.
You know, there are some marginal franchises in this league that have sold upwards from $500 million in cities and markets a fraction the size of Los Angeles without assets like Chris Paul and Blake Griffin and the sort of theatrics that the Clippers have really been able to brand themselves over the past couple of years. And the numbers you're hearing bounced around are $1 billion. The Los Angeles Dodgers went for $2 billion. And they're saying $1 billion to $1.5 billion potentially for the Clippers.
So Sterling walks away with some money in his pocket, right?
Sterling will profit, and that is if you're looking for a glass half empty. Yeah, he is going to be cash in for a guy who bought the team for $12 million. He's probably looking at a payday of, I mean, we can do the math, over maybe $1 billion.
Wow. This is a great exercise in crisis communications for the commissioner Adam Silver. He's been on the job a couple of months. This is the first big, you know, test is a lousy phrase. I hate that, but you know, how do you do?
He did very well. And in some respects, what the commissioner had to do today was not placate fans, not placate sponsors, placate the players' union. Kevin Johnson, the consultant to the players' union, you know, he had a press conference less than an hour following Adam Silver's on the steps of the City Hall in Los Angeles. And there was real concern that if the players' union did not hear what it wanted, he could get up on that podium and say, look, I've instructed all the players in the 8 playoff series to boycott the games. Instead, you know, Kevin Johnson got up on that podium and said, we are proud to call Adam Silver our commissioner.
Game 5 of the Clippers Warriors series is tonight. Do you think that today's news changes the dynamic in that game at all?
There's real optimism among Clippers fans who've loathed their owner for many years. So I think there's a sense that the clouds are lifting. You know, it'll be interesting to watch the human dynamic tonight.
Yeah, and this does take a little bit of the buzzkill out of what had been a dynamic playoff series.
Oh, the product has never been better. Obviously, the real crime here was, you know, people were dehumanized. Yeah. But I think beyond that, those looking at the product were sort of like, right now, seriously, during the best playoffs we've ever seen, he's going to do this? Come on.
Kevin Arnovitz covers the NBA for ESPN.com. Kevin, thanks a bunch.
Thanks for having me.
The NBA says, by the way, that $2.5 million check that Mr. Sterling is going to be writing will be donated to organizations that promote anti-discrimination and tolerance. Interestingly enough, though, those groups have already gotten a fair amount of money from Donald Sterling and his charitable foundations. Marketplace's Chrissy Clark makes that make sense.
If you live in L.A. and still read the newspaper, maybe you've seen the giant ads that Donald Sterling designs himself, promoting his donations to and awards from all sorts of community groups. Past ads have celebrated honors from the Black Business Association and his first Lifetime Achievement Award from the L.A. chapter of the NAACP.
He also has, over the years, contributed to a lot of minority charity.
That was NAACP's Leon Jenkins at a press conference Monday to explain why his L.A. chapter won't give Sterling a second Lifetime Achievement Award, as planned. And Sterling has been accused of racist behavior before, but that shouldn't make his donations to groups that promote tolerance that surprising, says Rob Reich. He directs Stanford's Center on Philanthropy and Civil Society.
Philanthropy has too frequently been a form of reputation laundering.
Using charitable gifts to wash your reputation has a long history, Reich says, like an oil company that gives a university money for a clean energy research center. In the case of Donald Sterling, he's known for small donations to dozens of community groups. That strategy has the benefit of maintaining your social status in local circles, Reich says. Regardless of Sterling's motivations, Augustine Pantoja, the financial manager at Jefferson High School in Los Angeles, says
he's helping our community.
And Pantoja says he won't refuse the annual $5,000 that Donald Sterling gives to help his students go to college. I'm Chrissy Clark for Marketplace.
Tuesdays have been very, very good to Wall Street of late. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Today, the European Union slapped sanctions on another 15 people that it says aided and abetted Vladimir Putin in Ukraine. It follows yesterday's moves by the U.S. Seven individuals and 17 companies were on the White House's new list. And you might infer a degree of coordination between the U.S. and European actions, the old 1-2 punch, if you will. Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports from London. Close on that one, but no cigar.
Today, the Europeans imposed travel bans and asset freezes on a further 15 people, bringing the total number targeted to 48. They all have one thing in common. They're all directly implicated in the Ukrainian crisis. That's not the case with the US sanctions, says John Luff of the Chatham House think tank.
The American approach has been much more targeted on Mr. Putin's inner circle and on businesses that are believed to be controlled by those individuals.
Like Igor Sechin, head of the Russian energy giant Rosneft, who was hit with an American asset freeze on Monday. A very close ally of President Putin, he's probably not had anything to do with Ukraine. Meanwhile, the Europeans today penalized, among others, several Ukrainian separatists and the head of Russian military intelligence, analyst Nick Redman.
You could say the Europeans are pussyfooting around in the sense that they are being more legalistic. They are going after the instruments of this policy rather than going for the most sensitive area of the Russian elite, which is the people around Putin.
The softer European approach is not surprising. The EU does 10 times as much trade with Russia as the US does. And Europe depends on Russia for 30% of its natural gas. Redman says don't expect the Europeans to hit the Russians where it really hurts, say in the energy sector, for fear of Russian retaliation.
Obviously, sanctions that would be more effective and would go further, they would impose higher costs on the imposing nations.
In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
It's not outside the realm of possibility that a year from now you could be watching your favorite television show on Yahoo. The company is going to roll out two original comedy series and a web channel for streaming live concerts. Yahoo is already right up there with Google as one of the internet's most visited places, but that's not doing it a whole heck of a lot of good finances-wise. So clearly, it's trying to shake things up, as Marketplace's Brie Benishore reports.
Are you bored with such award-winning shows as Orange is the New Black on Netflix?
Sadly, it's starting to feel like home in here.
Are you yearning for more than the same old hits like Game of Thrones available on your computer? I didn't think so, but that's not stopping Yahoo from trying to win you over.
What they're trying to do is keep up with the competition.
David Hallerman is an analyst at eMarketer. He says making shows for online viewing is still in its infancy, but it's becoming a crowded crib. That's because video ads make much more money than banners or pop-ups. And that's where Yahoo sees opportunity, says Hallerman. But it comes at a cost.
The advertising is lucrative. Of course, that sort of TV-like content is more expensive to make.
Netflix reportedly plans to spend $3 billion on content this year. Amazon spent $1 billion last year. But for a newcomer, high production value isn't enough.
To get the word out really is paramount.
Brian Steinberg is senior TV editor at Variety.
And one of the critiques of these companies that have been launching streaming video in the last couple of years from ad buyers is that no one knows this stuff is on.
And as new as this world of online programming is, it still has to deal with a very old-fashioned problem.
The track record for new programming is not great. Anyone in the TV business will tell you that 80% of new pilots fail.
So Yahoo's shows better be good and visible and viral. And for that, we'll have to tune in or type in or log in or whatever we have to do now. In New York, I'm Sabri Benashour for Marketplace.
Coming up.
To use the old Spinal Tap reference, this one goes up to 11. In Korea, they start at 11, and they go up from there.
Gangnam style. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial's up 86 points, about a half percent, closed at 16,535. Did the blue chips. The NASDAQ rose 29 points, about 0.7% there. Ended things at 4103. The S&P 500 up 8 points, a half percent, closed at 1878. Sprint bolted up 11.3% today on better than expected earnings and revenue forecasts. In-flight internet connectivity company Gogo tumbled 29% after, saints be praised, AT&T said it plans to launch a similar service. AT&T rang up 1% on that news. Internet stocks firmly in the black. Social media giant Twitter schmoozed up 4.2% today. That was before the bell, though. Reported first quarter results afterwards. Meh. What is that? How many characters? I don't know. All right, bond prices up. The yield on the 10-year T-note down to 2.69%. You're listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Wednesday. In Washington, the Commerce Department releases its first estimate for gross domestic product for the first quarter. Also in the nation's capital, students from around the country compete in the Poetry Out Loud National Finals. And 225 years ago, George Washington was sworn in as the nation's first president on the balcony of Federal Hall in New York. I'm Michelle Filippi.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. It was a rough day in the Lone Star State today. Item number one, the Supreme Court ruled this morning that the EPA can, in fact, order Texas and other states to cut down on coal-fired power plant pollution if said pollution drifts across state lines. Texas, it's important to know here, puts out more CO2 than any state in the country. It also uses the most energy, which brings us neatly to item two, the biggest electricity producer in Texas, Energy Future Holdings, it's called, filed for bankruptcy today. And therein lies a tale, as Marketplace's David Weinberg explains.
The saying, everything's bigger in Texas, is definitely true of Energy Future Holding. In 2007, Goldman Sachs and private equity firms acquired Energy Future for $45 billion, making it the biggest leveraged buyout ever.
It was very wealthy in terms of assets and delved in a great deal of matters involving energy.
Darren Bush is a law professor at the University of Houston. He says the deregulation of the Texas electricity market paved the way for the takeover of the utility.
Well, you know, one of the things that private equity does is private equity looks to acquire an asset they believe has potential upside.
Peter Cowan works in private equity as an investment banker. There were lots of reasons to believe in 2007 that owning the largest provider of electricity in the largest state in the U.S. had lots of potential upside. So the private equity firms loaded Energy Future with debt.
The problems, of course, are when the business becomes less valuable or there are meaningful hiccups.
Those meaningful hiccups can be caused by a larger economic downturn or from changes within the industry. In this case, it was both. The 2008 recession caused a decrease in energy use, and then came fracking, which drove the price of natural gas down, along with the utility's profits.
The reason that this is such a massive bankruptcy is because of the incredible fundamental change of the value of natural gas.
When Energy Future filed for bankruptcy today, its total assets were $36.4 billion. Its debt was nearly $50 billion. I'm David Weinberg from Marketplace.
Every year, the Chronicle of Philanthropy releases a list of the American charities that have raised the most money from private donors. United Way topped the most recent list. The Salvation Army was number three. Sliding in at number two is Fidelity Charitable. It was set up in 1991 by Fidelity, the gigantic financial services corporation. From the Wealth and Poverty Desk, Marketplace's Noel King has more.
Fidelity Charitable helps people set up donor-advised funds. Here's how they work. Instead of writing a $10,000 check to, say, the Salvation Army, you put the money into your Fidelity Charitable giving account. You can either invest the money or you can grant it right away. Amy Danforth is the president of Fidelity Charitable.
Granting is when they turn to the causes that they care about and log into our website or contact us by phone and make a grant to their alma mater, their church, the Red Cross, a food bank.
But why not just give the money directly to the food bank? Danforth says administering all the giving can be complicated. A donor-advised fund takes care of the paperwork for you. Donor-advised funds are booming. Stacey Palmer is editor of the Chronicle of Philanthropy.
They're growing like gangbusters. The rest of the charity world is growing very slowly, but donor-advised funds are seeing giant increases.
Among everyone.
It's a mix of average people and very wealthy people. You can put in as little as $3,000 in some of these accounts, or you can put in many millions of dollars.
Once that money hits your donor-advised fund, you can write it off on your taxes. But then there's no deadline for when you have to give it away. The money can just sit there. Ray Madoff is a professor at Boston College Law School.
There is no time limit at all. So the money can stay in the fund for a decade, a century, or many centuries.
Fidelity Charitable makes donors give away some part of the money within 7 years. But as with any donor-advised fund, you can give away a tiny fraction of the money and still get the tax deduction for the full amount. I'm Noel King for Marketplace.
Part of what the Affordable Care Act is supposed to do is to help poor Americans get health insurance, because people without coverage typically don't get preventive care, and those little things that don't get looked at eventually become big, expensive things. And that helps explain why low-income, and especially rural Americans, tend to see higher rates of chronic disease. For years, nonprofits have stepped in to fill that healthcare gap gratis. Jonna McCone has more on that.
182!
Outside of a big building at a fairground in Knoxville, hundreds of people wait in line. They come from nearby cities and small towns with names like Coalfield and Deer Lodge. They're here for a two-day clinic called Remote Area Medical. It's a place for poor people to get free medical services, from dental to vision to yearly checkups.
I was struggling and running out of reading glasses. It was just getting too weak.
James Barlow is 47. He got his first pair of glasses 2 years ago at the clinic. Today, he's due for a new pair.
Looks like you're all set, sir, okay?
Barlow needs health insurance. In 2008, he was hospitalized for a heart attack.
They knew when I come into the emergency room, I couldn't afford it. If they hadn't forced me to stay in the hospital, I would have went home and probably died.
And he had another heart attack this past year. Barlow's medical bills have cost tens of thousands of dollars, but like a lot of people here, he can't afford to buy his own insurance, even with subsidies. Some patients drove for hours the night before to get here. They slept in their cars nearby. Amy Smith is a nurse and volunteer.
I don't know a whole lot of people who would stand in a line for 24 hours if they had a better plan, if they had an easier way to get what they needed.
That's the case with Brittany and Dustin Scalf. They're both in their mid-20s. Brittany says she hasn't gone to the dentist in 6 or 7 years.
When I turned 18, I got pregnant, and then I just quit going.
A lot of people here are used to not having health insurance in their family.
His mom's on disability, and my dad's on disability.
For Dustin's mother,
she never really tried to get it until she got sick and had to go to the doctor.
Yeah, and then she got it, but still, and then it was too late, and she already owed thousands and thousands of dollars.
A few hours later, Brittany's finally in the dental chair.
But a little more of a pinch here, okay? Try and hold open for me.
The dentist removes four teeth from the back of her mouth.
Let's rinse you out some here, okay? You did good.
Hopefully, procedures like this one are a thing of the past, because Dustin has a new job, and it'll come with health insurance. The couple heads to their camper to make the two-hour trip back to Hawkins County, Tennessee. As for so many people here today, this trip is a painful reminder of the past few years without health insurance.
I'm just ready to get home.
I know.
It's been a long day.
In Knoxville, I'm Jonna McCone for Marketplace.
There's a better than even chance that were I to ask you about K-pop, that is Korean pop music, the very first thing you would think about would be this.
Oppan Gangnam Style.
Gangnam Style by Psy, which you must have heard at some point in the last year and a half or so. Fact is, though, that K-pop is oh so much more than that one song. Mark Russell has been writing about Korean music and popular culture for years now. His new book about it is called K-pop Now, with the exclamation point. Mark, it's good to have you here.
Good to be here.
One of the things I was struck by in this book, because, of course, when I picked it up and started reading it, I was looking for Gangnam Style and Psy and all of that. You basically said, listen, K-pop has been around for a long, long time, but it wasn't until Gangnam Style and Psy that the West, and this is your quote, got the joke. What does that mean?
I guess for me, often Asia occupies a strange mental place with people in the West, and they some people think it's exotic or weird or goofy. Often they're looking at it or laughing at it. But when people enjoyed Gangnam Style, it felt like they were laughing with it.
Am I saying it wrong? Not Gangnam Style, but Gangnam Style?
The word in Korean, the letter, is kind of halfway between a G and a K.
Oh, all right. So maybe what we ought to do then is give another example of Gangnam Style that you told us about before we went on the radio. So let's roll this. It's from a group called EXO, and it's a song called Growl, and we'll play just a bit of that. All right, so, you know, it's not exactly a catchy tune, but it's got some identifiable things. How do you know what is and isn't K-pop?
That's a really hard one to pin down, because K-pop from very early on was looking to get out of Korea, was looking to be more international, and so they've brought in songwriters from other places. They buy a lot of music from Scandinavia, you know, Universal Music, Europe. They sell a lot of stuff to Korea. And I know I've talked several times with the head of A&R there, and he has taken away songs from American artists and given them to K-pop artists because he views the right combination can be more profitable in Korea.
Sure.
But when we think about idol music, there's usually upbeat dance music. It's very loud. It's very flashy. To use the old Spinal Tap reference, this one goes up to 11. Korea, they start at 11, and they go up from there.
Well, it very much seems, actually, that it is a machine, this K-pop enterprise, right? It's very, very organized and deliberate, and there are certain things that groups do. There are certain, makeup that members have to have and all of that stuff.
Very true. These are big companies, and they've been working at it for a while, and it's a very high-risk, high-reward field. If you don't keep up on the latest trends, you'll lose popularity. And in a kind of a interesting part about the Korean music industry is there's really no catalog. In the West, companies make as much money from their old music as they do from the new music, from Beatles or whoever.
Yeah.
But no one who listens to Korean music really spends a lot of money on 10-year-old music and 20-year-old music. So that makes the hits much more important to the life of any company.
Here comes the sociocultural question, if I could. I think the second or third chapter in this book, pretty early on, you talk about the land of K-pop and how important Seoul as a city and then the rise of the South Korean economy has been in the rise of K-pop.
It's been a whole series of changes that go back quite a ways from the rise of democracy and the Olympics in 88 and just the country opening up. It's become a much more lifestyle-oriented country. For many years, people worked 6 days a week, worked very long hours. But now, you know, people have more money and more free time, and they want to fill that time with fun things. Movies have become very, very successful. People want all the little things in life.
Mark Russell, his book is called K-Pop Now, The Korean Music Revolution. Mark, thanks a lot.
Thank you so much.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, in which you got your low-cost airlines, then you got your ultra-low-cost airlines. Frontier has a new pricing structure. Base fares are going to go down about 12%, but if you want to use the overhead bin, it's going to be $20 for frequent flyers who book online with a carry-on bag, $50 for those who wait till they get to the gate to decide they need the space up top. That space at your feet, though, under the seat in front of you, that's still free for now. All right, we're done. We got to go. That is Marketplace from APM. Nancy Fargali is our senior producer of special projects. Caitlin Esch works on the Wealth and Poverty Desk. Our digital producers are Ariana Tobin and Shay Huffman. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you back here tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.